This is a crime novel set in London. This part of the book is quite close to the end of the book, but these aren't crossword puzzles, so I don't think it reveals too much apart from the unpleasantness of some of the people involved in this story. The background to where we join this is that investigator Slim Gunter, while looking into the death of a man called Barnaby Chase, has ended up visiting his estranged father, Mark Chase. And before we join it, he's been in Chase's house, and Chase is a rather peculiar chap with a somewhat religious bent. And while they were talking, someone's kicked the front door in. I should also say that there is some fairly strong language, so please try not to be too offended. This is chapter 27. The door stayed on its hinges, but only just. Chase looked like he hadn't done quite as well, shouting something I couldn't make out, jumping up and knocking over his chair in the process. The noise of the door being booted in and the crash of the wooden seat onto the lino floor gave way to nothing but the low hiss of the candles. The man in the doorway was wearing a tweed jacket, jeans, and what looked like motorcycle boots worn outside the trousers. He was well over 6 feet tall, rail thin, and had deeply sunken eyes. The flames from the candles made his face look a yellow colour, and his thick hair, which looked blonde to me, stood almost straight up from his scalp. If I'd had any left, mine would have done much the same. I stood next to Chase, who had his mouth open, looking at one of the candles lying on its side, leaking molten wax onto the vinyl. The man turned round and closed the door quite gently. The lock would be gone, but the door still fitted back into place. Switching the light on, he looked round the room, nodding slowly. In the glow of the single bare bulb, I could see that his eyes were red round the edges. I also got my first proper look at the size of his nose. Simply enormous, just like the nasty queen in Russell Square had said. The blood charging along my capillaries should have been clinking in a tall gin and tonic. Asher Grant showed his teeth and then giggled. They looked pretty good, as far as I could tell, but I didn't like the sound of his chuckling. Chase stood beside me, showing as much movement as Lot's wife. Grant bent down and put the chair back upright. "You," he pointed at Chase, "sit here." Chase walked like a Haitian under the command of Baron Sandy. His face was made of the same stuff as the tea lights all over the floor. Grant pushed down on one of his shoulders and then turned to me. He giggled again. I was really finding them that day. One of my new friends was high above the cloud line with a harp and an inaudible choir, while the other gave off all the signs of someone who had a bit more than fruit juice with his breakfast. The Jesus freak sat still, looking at his children, fixed forever onto a piece of shiny paper. The speed version looked round the room again and then bent over to pick up one of the small candles, a thin piece of wax with a tall tapering flame. He walked towards me, reaching into his pocket with his free hand. I couldn't see what he pulled out. "Asher Grant," I said by way of an introduction. "You?" He laughed again. "A rather a nuisance." The voice was from North London, sprinkled with plenty of powder that made the heart race, the teeth grind and the brain desiccate. Like coconut, I thought, for no reason at all. He moved in, closer than manners dictate. But it wasn't etiquette that bothered me. The flame tickled my nose and I heard a crackle, followed by the smell of burnt hair. I moved my head back. "I had a facial last week, thanks all the same." I took a step away from him, freeing my arms. "A nuisance, a damned nuisance." The whiz in his diction didn't hide an educated tone to the way he spoke. "Do you really think I'd have much trouble with such a short, fat slob?" "I'm not fat," I said, "just comfortable." "Fatty, fatty." Grant had enough wire in him to run a cable to the moon, but he's right, I wouldn't last 2 minutes with a giant speed freak. His face alone was enough to give me the creeps. I felt like some Antarctic trawlerman looking at a giant squid for the first time. "Look, the fat man is scared." Grant's smile made my stomach feel empty. I could have had a swing at him, hoping for the lucky haymaker. But he was right. The fear I felt crawled up my back like the nameless creature of a child's nightmare. But there's nothing to be scared of, Fatso. He pushed the flame towards my nose again, and I turned my face to one side, feeling the skin start to burn. Well, not much. Roll of pound coins, probably, wrapped in stiff paper, they'd fit into the palm of his long-fingered hand. Or a simple plain metal bar. It didn't matter what he used. Nothing mattered except the explosion at the side of my head that splashed a yellow light in front of my eyes. Here we go again. I slid to the floor, my hand sliding down his denim-covered legs. For fuck's sake. Eddie's voice came to me in a dream. I was lying in a satin-lined box surrounded by the glow of 1,000 lights. He stood over my coffin, cheering on a Romeo y Julieta and shaking his large head. Barclay, dressed as an archbishop, read the eulogy. Lady was there too, wearing a lace veil and a pair of black opera gloves. I lay back on my soft pillows of oyster-coloured silk and smiled. Peace and quiet and the love of good friends. Come on, son, time to get going. No time for pissing about. I opened an eye to see Barclay kneeling beside me and Ed gently tapping the side of my face. I was dreaming, I said, feeling a sharp pain over one ear, as though something with four legs and iron shoes had kicked me. Well, it's time for work now, mate. Think you can stand up? I moved into a sitting position and touched the side of my head. It was tacky, but not running out of me. When I looked down at my hand, it didn't show any marks, but I could see black flecks like fish eggs in a pond swimming across my vision. Get these fucking candles out, Eddie gestured at Barclay, stood up and wet his thumb and finger. Here, take my hand, Slim. I held on to Eddie's warm, dry hand and let myself be pulled up. I managed to stand, swaying a little, as I watched each of the small flames being extinguished. Even in the half-light cast by an orange street lamp, I could see the photograph sitting on the mantelpiece. Nobody said anything until Eddie got the car past the Bow flyover. As we headed up the Mile End Road, he let out a long breath, swung the car over and pulled up just short of a bus stop. Two pairs of eyes turned back to where I was lying in the rear seats. I saw you take off and the wagon, the police wagon, following on, I said. Did you get a tug? Eddie shook his head. No, but I didn't want to give him the chance. And I think that's the local way of padding the beat. That and the big bird in the sky, I said. Community policing. How's the head? This one makes the Holy Trinity. One on the back of the nut in Russell Square. The station floor got me on the other side. Now this one. I was collecting enough mice to open a pet shop. The face is intact, though. Eddie didn't say if that was a good thing or not. We were only gone for about 30 minutes, Arthur. Barclay wore an expression like a strangled poodle. Relax, B, I said. Nothing you could do, and things would probably have turned out much the same anyway. Eddie made his nasal grunting noise again. None of us really believed it, but like the losing team on a Sunday morning park pitch, we needed to take our comforts from somewhere. Eddie turned the key and moved the car back into the thin stream of traffic, heading back towards the city. Ashish was just about to shut the off license when we got back. He smiled at the three of us, looking surprised that we were turning up for work at nearly 10 in the evening. Eddie nodded at him and put the clothes sign into position before walking to the fridge and lifting out an armful of beer cans. Ashish read the signs on Eddie's face, killed the lights and turned on the mechanism that lowered the shutters over the front of the shop. Upstairs in the office, Eddie sat on the edge of his desk and cracked one. You know what I think? He took a slug and tapped his pockets for a smoke. I reckon we should just lead them to it. Who gives a flying fuck what that pair are up to? I hate to agree with that prick with the tash, but I can see his point. The pain in my head dropped a couple of notches on the dial as I swallowed some cold liquid. The thumping had calmed down to a gentle beat, but was accompanied by a nagging feeling that no amount of beer would get rid of. And after all, Eddie carried on, I don't mean to be unkind, but who's left to be pissed off? There's Prue, Ed. Chase's mother. and she might not just be in line to be pissed off. I looked at Eddie's indignant bulldog's face. She might, I said, even be in the frame for something rather worse than that. Point taken. Sorry, mate. His face moved from canine to ovine. And, I said, Chase Sr. could easily be the innocent party in this. He didn't strike me as being capable of anything more dangerous than burning his own house down. Now he's off with Grant, who, alibi or not, is a very nasty item indeed. You mean Chase isn't in league with him and is now out of a slim frying pan into a big nose fire? I slapped my desk. Eddie Scarborough, I almost shouted, you're a fucking genius. They both looked at me as if my head injury was worse than they thought. This might be a stretch. I wrote some things on my pad in front of me. But think about that word for a minute. What word? Eddie looked confused. Fire. Before Grant snuffed out my candle, he pushed a flame into my face. Here. I pushed up the end of my nose. I bet there's a red mark there, and I can feel the ends of the nostril hair, all balled up and crunchy. Saved you 10 minutes with the Remington. Eddie's tone was even. And what does that signify, Arthur? Said Parkley. I remain in a state of bewilderment. In Goose's place, there was a rubbishy old 2-bar electric fire. It had the grill missing. I wondered about it at the time. I thought maybe Goose had tripped over it. It's an old one, Slim. Eddie cut in. An old one, but a good one. Wish you'd mentioned it before. Perhaps he was right, but I wasn't sure what good it would have done. I am sorry, gentlemen, Barclay wore a perplexed expression. I endure in the darkness. Eddie pulled out a cigar that might have doubled as a broom handle. Mr. Lloyd, he said, a few years ago, when there were more bedsits than swanky flats in this neighbourhood, a lot of low-level dealing went on. Probably still does. I wouldn't know these days. If you got anything on tick and didn't pay the bunts, there were a few different ways of encouraging prompt payment. One of the dealers, nasty piece of work, can't remember his name, used the cheap fires. He'd rip the front off, plug the thing in, and shove it in the face of anyone who pissed him off. Barclay looked appalled. Yeah, I said, it gives you a nice warm feeling, doesn't it? Mackenzie had told me that Asher Grant sold jazz magazines and Puff while he was still at school. That didn't prove anything in itself, but when I added to it his nutty speed demeanour and his giggling game with the burning wicks, I didn't have to do too many mental somersaults to come up with a low-rent dealer of some kind. To add to the mix, I had an arrest record that placed Grant in Piccadilly, selling fake draw to hopeful kids, making some extra gravy with stock cubes. It didn't take anything athletic at all to have him learning an old and unpresent trick from one of the older boys on the street. He was bright. He'd have learned his lessons fast and well. I'd have wagered a dry cleaning bill that maybe Grant had been on the receiving end of someone with a debt collect, a bad temper and a 50 pence for the meter. Then there was his girlfriend, Goose's sister, who needed something to shed her clothes and inhibitions in the Rocket pub. Wasn't hard to see him providing the propane. I had a fairly good idea of Grant's life and work. What I didn't have was a single shred of evidence placing Grant in Goose's flat. White had sneered, telling me that Grant had worked on the night of the death in a pub. But just because he might not have been there when Goose let go of his lucky feather, it didn't mean he didn't have a hand in it somewhere. Where next? Eddie read the question off the ticker tape running across my forehead. Easy. Well, to say, anyway, we've got to find the pair of them. I crunched my can, which made me remember that my hands hurt. At least it took attention away from the side of my head and the inside, both of which would give me enough trouble to be going on with. Do you have any idea of how that might be achieved? Barclay was given to rhetorical flourishes, but they weren't normally questions. No, I held out my hands. No, I don't.